contract to write a book about multimedia. Okay?
Yeah.
And we decided we were going to spend a week in Provincetown working on it. And I made the error, according to him, of having Sally come up there. She flew up from Boston when she was going to school at Simmons. And so John wound up writing by the late John Brockman, and we never wrote the media book.
But that gives us a date. That shows that you did meet Sally in 69.
All right.
Because the book comes out in 69, because I was in Seattle. And there
maybe it was 68 then.
No, yeah, it might take a year to get out. I was in Seattle in 69 and got a copy of Walter's East Village Other one weekend and read a review of by the late John Brockman by, guess who? Judd Yalkut.
Okay.
Your old buddy Judd. And, yeah. You know, he was a regular columnist for the East Village Other at that time. And he made great pronouncements for it, for the book. But that's in 69, so we're talking you meeting Sally. I mean, this hotel experience with Sally is early in your relationship with her, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we got a date, 69, and that's when intermedia is happening. Because you meet Rudy, and you meet Sally, and then that leads to intermedia.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Okay. So, 69. Nixon is president. Now, I'm going to go back to Ken Dewey. His death, plane crash or whatever it was, car crash, he died.
Plane
crash. It had the same depressing effect on you as Lou Hill dying. You suggest
no.
It was even suicidal.
Well, that's a question that's never been answered.
Right, there was some, was it, yeah. It was,
about Ken, yeah.
Yeah, it was,
the family is of the opinion that there was a failure of the plane, of something in the plane which had supposedly been repaired just previously. And Ken had left his girlfriend to drive up from, I can't remember the route, but then he got caught in some bad weather, and it's fairly inexplicable. But he had serious psychological scenes, depression.
Right, it's not, you're not suggesting he might have been murdered.
No.
No. You're saying that
it may have been a problem with the airplane, and it may have been suicide.
Right, because you're saying, like Lou Hill, he had a lot of emotional.
Lou Hill was definitely suicide.
Right, but it was due to emotional involvement with different people, involvement
different women.
Different
yes.
women. Ken, you're saying might have had
Ken
that.
also had problems with women.
Right. So the. And is that, what, do you know when that was? Are you an intermediate?
He wasn't a big, I mean, he didn't have a lot of women.
Right, but he,
He had a black girlfriend. He was into black, and then he had a very beautiful white girlfriend who later on in New York had one of those bondage theater experiences. I mean, she ran it.
Right.
I can't remember either of their names.
That would be in the late 70s in the gay bar scene period.
There was no gay about it.
Just bondage.
It was heterosexual.
Right. In talking about Ken Dewey's funeral, in passing is mentioned the name Yvonne. There might be a reference earlier, but I couldn't find it. Like, who's Yvonne and why is that mentioned? I think she was an artist. I don't know why you mentioned Yvonne. But
Yvonne Rainer, R-A-I-N-E-R. Why did I mention Johnson, or
I don't know. Yeah, just in passing.
I guess she was there. I mean, she was a friend of mine. She's a very famous dancer.
Yeah, I recognize the name now. Rayner, Yvonne Rayner.
She and I went out together in San Francisco.
Ah, because you just mentioned it in passing, so there's probably an earlier point where you mentioned Yvonne Rayner.
Yeah, and her brother Ivan. Yeah.
What about her brother Ivan?
I don't know. He was a carpenter in San Francisco. I also knew him.
Okay, so did you meet at the Howard Wise Gallery? Did you know Paul Ryan?
I knew Paul Ryan, I think, because of Fordham.
Right. Because you dropped in at Fordham when McLuhan and Carpenter.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was Carpenter's assistant, I think.
I don't know about that, but he was there.
Yeah, see,
he was working with Marshall. I don't know that he...
No, he was. He was a priest.
He had been a priest. Not a priest, but a...
Seminarian?
Yes, a Franciscan, I believe.
Right, and
he and I are still friendly.
Right, and he lives in New York. He teaches at the New School of Social Research. But Paul told me that he was listening to WBAI about 66, and he heard a tape of McLuhan talking. And that really got him interested in McLuhan, and then I don't know how he got involved and ended up at Fordham, but through Carpenter, maybe he took a course from Carpenter or something.
No, I believe he became involved through Father Culkin.
Okay, yeah, maybe, no, you might be right. I don't know why I'm getting the Carpenter thing in. Could be Carpenter.
John was, all over the place.
Yeah, and a priest himself, right?
Yes, oh, wonderful. He was one of the people I really liked.
Oh, you knew John?
Sure. I knew him then, and I knew him much later. You know, he used to come up to Boston during the intermediate days.
He was aware of that. He was aware of what you were doing in intermediate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he was. And he was a friend of a woman who did photography for us. And it's still around up there, Bobby Carey. And she did something for him in New York City. He was involved in, what was that project?
Who, Culkin?
Yeah.
Well, McLuhan told me that he ran a center, almost the same name as Marshall had, Center for Culture and Technology, but it might have been Understanding Media, Center for Culture and Technology, something like that,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
And your photographer knew him in
worked,
that...
Worked for him there, yeah.
Yeah, he... it makes
and
sense.
He was into Esperanto.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
It makes sense that Paul would connect with McLuhan through Father Culkin, because...
I can ask him, but that somehow makes more sense.
No, it does, because he's a seminarian or whatever he is.
Yeah.
He's going to connect through McLuhan through the Catholic hierarchy or Catholic environment.
Exactly.
At Fordham.
Well, Fordham is a Catholic.
Yeah, so maybe Culkin hired him, and that's why he was at Fordham with McLuhan, because Culkin ran it. You know, I met a priest, I don't know if he's a priest, Edward Wakin, W-A-K-I-N, back in 98. And at Fordham, I was at Fordham, and he told me that year of having McLuhan have the Albert Schweitzer chair at Fordham, 67 to 68, was a disaster for the Fordham College or University, because they had promised McLuhan like $100,000 or something, and the state, they were going to use state funds. But for some reason...
Yeah, I mean, it was state money, but then there was a... legal scandal.
Yeah, the state decided that they were a private university and would not give the money. So Wakin says they had
The other problem was that they thought of Marshall as Canadian.
Yeah.
So there was a double problem, and it was a big trip.
Yeah.
Very, very, very negative trip.
Yes, and so McLuhan, they had to
and
go...
Culkin, Culkin lost a lot of his influence. You know, he, Father John went to the to Rome to persuade the Pope and cardinals to put up a satellite of their own, and of course that he was laughed out of the papacy.
Yeah, and that was McLuhan's idea. But just to finish this, so Edward Wakin said they had to go into their own budget, Fordham, to pay McLuhan, and he said, we never recovered from that debt. He said, Fordham never recovered. He's telling me this 30 years later.
Well, that's ridiculous, because $100,000 to a huge university can't be, you know, a 30-year problem.
Well, anyways, it's a myth that it was a disaster, and I guess the ones that weren't connected to it, they're still working there, and Culkin lost everything. I mean, he actually gave up being a priest, I think, or being a father. I think he left the church.
Yeah, when he formed that, you know, that little, whatever.
Understanding Media.
Nonprofit.
Yeah. Did you say nonprofit?
Yep.
Yeah. So, so Paul Ryan, Culkin, and you met Harley Parker in that period when he was at Fordham?
Well, I met Harley up in Toronto originally, but yeah, I think he came down. Yeah, I have a feeling he came down.
I haven't heard of your stories. You actually visited the Coach House, or before the Coach House. It would be before the Coach House, because the Coach House was after Fordham. So you visited McLuhan at the original place with the Center for Cultural
Studies. I think I visited him at two different places.
Right, you probably visited him at the... Do you remember the Coach House? You know, back in the parking lot?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been the second place. What do you remember about McLuhan when you visited him in Toronto? Did you know Toronto at all?
No.
What,
not at all.
Did he show...
I only came there to see him.
And you had a meeting in his office?
Yep.
And
I think we had lunch, dinner. I think, I can't remember if I went to his house with, I met his wife a number of times.
Yeah, you probably went to his house unless she came to the office. So what, is there any particular...
But I also met her in New York.
Okay, is there any particular story or anecdote or knowledge that you remember?
No, I mean... It was, Ted wasn't there, but Harley was.
Yeah, Harley basically replaced Ted. I mean, Ted left Marshall in 1959. That early, and then he was out.
Yeah, but they were still friends because Marshall basically pushed me to get to know Ted.
Right. No, they were friends. They kept in touch. They did the. What became the book, They Became What They Beheld, with Ted and some photographer, I don't have it here, Ken somebody. It originally was in Harper's Bazaar magazine, a spread of commentary by Marshall and Ted with photographs. Do you recall that in New York?
Yes, I remember the book, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of the magazine that it was in before it became the book.
No, I don't remember that.
That reminds me, since it was serialized in the Los Angeles Free Press, did you know any of the people around that area, like Charles Bukowski, Art Kunkin, any of the writers?
I met Bukowski. I don't know. In L.A., I mostly knew film people and artists.
And I mentioned Judd Yolcott. You knew him for a long time, back in the 60s.
For a very long time. I mean, we started him as a filmmaker.
Right, so you're... The Howard Wise Gallery was the first gallery to present video, right? I think it was the beginning of that, because Paul Ryan presented stuff. I think he was part of, not Global Village, but some video group.
Yeah, I had New Paul's.
Yeah, they were up in New Paltz.
Yeah.
And they had a little network there. They could put their tapes on there.
Yeah, there three guys. I can't remember the other people.
So did you did you present anything at the Howard Wise Gallery?
Yeah, we that's when we had that big piece, which, you know,
And you go to his mansion, and after you lug in the equipment in what he bought down into his gallery, and he had just removed the op art collection from the year before.
Right.
And then you install, what are you installing in his place?
7 diffraction hex, but it was in his bomb shelter.
Right, he turned it into a gallery.
Right.
And you found it unpleasant hanging out with him. You had some wine with him.
He invited us in for a drink, and then he showed us his favorite work of art, which was his bronze marine boots.
Yeah. Okay, the overlap here is that Malcolm Forbes funded... No, he was going to do the press conference in 1990 where he would declare his support and urge for more funding of the AIDS treatment that Carolyn got involved in. It was the reason we went to New York. And he died before the press conference. So it didn't happen. So the person that Carolyn worked with, the inventor of this health modality, had to get other funding. And I understand Malcolm Forbes got involved with this modality because his lover, he apparently was gay or bisexual, his gay lover had HIV, and the modality was helping his lover. So I bring that up. Did you think of him as gay?
Certainly not.
Yeah.
He was married.
Right.
Right.
So I don't know how public that became about
him. He had a son who was in the motorcycle business.
What's the motorcycle business? You mean those Honda things?
I don't know. Forbes was a big motorcycle fan. And his son had some kind of a business for hot motorcycles. Racing. So,
right.
That he told us about. Anyway.
Looking at my notes, I see next Peter Barron's article had some good quotes, and that leads to a friendship. Peter Barron, B-E-R-E-N?
Yep.
What was it about the article?
In the Boston Phoenix.
Oh, yeah, that got attention for Intermedia. There's this thing you did called Fan Flashtick. Is that what you sold to Malcolm Forbes?
No, that was something else. Fan Flashstick was part of the Intermedia 68 tour for the New York State Council.
See, there's Intermedia 68. It's happening in 68. So Intermedia probably started in 67 then. Let's assume
The Fan Flashstick was an USCO project. We did show it as part of when we started in Intermedia in Boston, but that wasn't part of Intermedia 68, which was a New York State Council of the Arts project that had nothing to do with Intermedia system.
Right, so that's 68, so it looks like Intermedia was formed in 69.
Maybe.
You and Sally give birth to Abram, and Abram is the person I had email contact with a few years ago. Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is Abram doing today?
Abram is with an associate, has a large grant from the Sunlight Foundation in Washington. He has a master's thesis at UC Santa Cruz. Developed a search engine, and they take the feed from the House of Representatives in the Senate, and you can put in a phrase or a name or a word, and you can get all the video clips with the audio that have that word in them, and you can use it as public access as a filmmaker or an art piece or whatever you want to use it at. And before that, I can't remember the name of the company. It's a not-for-profit, which is owned by all the cable companies. It's not CBC, but it's one of those three-letter things. And they tried to sue them, saying that they're not allowed to use that material because it belongs to them. But the university at Santa Cruz Legal Department came in and said, hey, it's public information. It's a fee that the government pays for. You just, and that they charge for it. They take it off the feed. And
who charges for it?
That company. You must know. Who has?
We're not talking about Abrams Company. We're talking about the Corporation of Public Broadcasting,
DPB? No, it's an other acronym. It's the people who've kind of put the Senate on video for years.
Oh, C-SPAN.
C-SPAN, that's what I'm talking about. C-SPAN tried to sue them. And they said, well, we've defended this for 20 years, and the university said, just try it one more time. If you think you own the government feed, we don't think you do. And they backed off. So they have a URL, and it's available to anybody now.
So Abram worked with the guy.
They maintain it every day.
And Abram helped invent it, or he worked for the company?
Yes. He and his associate, they wrote their master's thesis together.
So you've got two sons with technological abilities, potential. I mean, Zalman is the one who goes on and does Photoshop. Can you explain, if you can,
Photoshop and Final Cut.
Did he invent those processes?
No. No, Tom Nolan had the idea for Photoshop, and Zalman wrote a lot of the code for it, and he then wrote a lot of the code for Macromedia for Final Cut, and he now is back because Adobe bought Macromedia, is now back working on Photoshop, still photography with Tom Nolan, who's in Ann Arbor. On two programs called Lightroom and RAW Files.
So it's interesting that, I mean, I see Michael Callahan as the technical wizard, but you understood some of it, but he did the programming. I don't know, are you a programmer?
No, he's not either. He's an electronic engineer, but Zalman is a code writer.
So Zalman and Abram both, in a way, following in your footsteps, are techno-cultural workers, techno-culture.
And Eric is a television engineer who's right now in Singapore building HD studios for Ascent Media, which is one of the Liberty Group.
Who's Eric?
He's my son that I didn't know about until 8 or 9 years ago.
Oh, who was the mother? Anybody we discussed?
Jackie Gibson around Christopher McLean and Allen Ginsberg and Neil and Jack.
How old is Eric?
Late 40s.
So he was born in the late 50s. Right. That's the Ginsberg Beatnik era, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
he called me up about nearly 10 years ago and kept asking me questions, and I finally asked him what it's all about. He said that what it's all about is your name is on my birth certificate as my father. I said, who's your mother? He said, she died recently, is why I'm calling you. Because she didn't want me to get in touch with you. And with Jackie Gibson. I said, oh my goodness, the last time I heard from Jackie, she told me she was pregnant by Jack Kerouac. And he said, yeah, she wanted to marry him at that time, but of course they never did, and she guaranteed me that you were my father. Well, it's certainly possible.
So she was someone that you had a short relationship with?
Yep.
Now, that reminds me, Jared, he dies, and does he die in the 70s?
Or
is he in the 80s? Or 90s?
Early 90s.
Early 90s. When does Judy die?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. So Jared dies in the early 90s, and he was born in the late 50s from Ann London, right?
Uh-huh. That's right.
So Zalman, Eric, and Abram.
Yep.
So you had five kids.
Six.
You got...
Adam.
Adam.
Retta.
Retta.
Jared.
Zalman. That's four. And then Eric.
Abram. Abram, and then Eric comes along.
Oh, yeah, Adam.
And Eric was about the same time as Jared.
Right. So that's Adam, Retta, Jared, Eric, Zalman, and Abram. Okay. So, did you have... Who is the closest son now with you? Or are they all equally connected to you?
Zalman.
Zalman.
Uh-huh.
And you...
But my daughter is probably the closest altogether.
Right, because Zalman... you didn't see much of any of your kids other than Abram as a father, right? Because the wives would keep the mothers would keep the kids away from you.
No, that wasn't true of anybody except him.
And Zalman. Didn't Judy keep Zalman?
No.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he lived with her until he was 13 and then she died.
Then she what?
She had had it. She couldn't take him anymore.
Oh, so you took him in?
Yes. He lived with Sally and I.
So what is the story about how he's scouted by Carnegie Mellon? Because he's a...
He's not scouted by Carnegie Mellon. The story is he comes here when he's 13 to Creskill, and he says to me, Papa, I need a color printer. What do you mean you need a color printer? I mean, we had been close. He went to Venezuela with us for a summer. I mean, et cetera, et cetera. I never didn't see Zalman. Anyway, so he was a tough little kid. So I said, come on, Zalman. Color printers are very expensive. He said, the second day, Papa, I need a color printer. I borrowed the money to buy a color printer. It was huge at the time, you know, and expensive. I don't know, because, you know, I always liked technology, so, I mean, I was empathetic. And I think it was by that time I had started in the cheese business.
This would be in the 80s. I mean, what year was Zalman born? If you... Late 60s?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is early 80s. So he wants a color printer.
Wait a minute. If it's late 60s, he's 13. Let's say 69, 79, 82. Yeah, maybe, yeah. So he gets one. And but now he's spending all night long working on the computer and the color printer, and he sleeps at school. Eventually, in toward the end of his second year, his math and computer teacher calls me and says, "Mr. Stern, we don't have anything more to teach Solomon. This is ridiculous. He just had to have him at Driscoll High School. Get him early admission to a university." So he wants to go to MIT, but MIT, when we go up to, they say no. If he wants to wait until he graduates, it seems like a likely prospect, but we're not giving him early admission. We don't do that. I don't know if it's true or not. We go to Carnegie Mellon, and they snap him right up.
And how old is he then, 15?
Yeah. So.
So he had mastered high school math and whatever else they teach by the time he's 15.
He had taught himself C, which is a computer language.
Right.
So then he was at Carnegie Mellon for a couple of years, and they gave him like some kind of a grant, and then they hired him at the Educational Technology Center for, I can't remember, I think it was $30,000 a year. He didn't graduate. I went down and I complained to the president and said, you know, I send my son to college to get a degree, and you hire him, and then you tell him that he can't continue to go to school because it's a conflict of interest. He says to me, "Look, Mr. Stern, I understand what you're saying. But what you don't understand is that my faculty can't do this kind of work. The only people we can get to do this kind of work is hackers like your son, and I have nearly 100 of them working here at the center. And they know what they're doing. And we treat them very well. Yeah, they give them all the big gulps that they can drink free."
Oh, the big what?
Big gulps. It's like, you know, the sodas like Coke and everything, but in these huge cups. They can have it all day long as much as they want. And then Zalman is hooked for a while. But, so, I say to him, "Look, President, I can't remember his name right now. It starts with an S, started with an S. He's no longer there, but, I could take this very badly, and I think since I'm a writer, what I would like to do is to write an article about this. Then this is corrupt. I know who's funding your center. It's IBM. And if they hire these kids, they'd have to pay them a lot more than you pay them, and you're taking advantage, and then you're preventing them from getting their degrees." He says, "I can't stop you, Mr. Stern. It would not be a very pleasant." As we leave the room, Solomon and I, we out in the hall, Solomon says, "Papa, don't fuck things up for me." So, okay, so I don't do anything. Well, 2 months later, a headhunter comes along and grabs Solomon and sells him to Adobe for twice what he's making. He's been going ever since.
And he'd be about 19 when that, or 18?
Yeah, something like that.
He was at Carnegie Mellon for a couple of years, say.
Yep.
So 17, 18. So, yeah, how old is he now? Do you know? Can you say?
In his 40s.
Okay, late 40s, so he's born in the late 60s.
I don't know about
So he's been working with computers. Did he ever take a break?
No.
He's obsessed. He loves the language.
He's a code writer, you know, and he's very good at debugging and code, and he says computers suck.
In what sense? He doesn't like having to be stuck and working with them, or he says they're...
No, he likes working them, but he feels that the industry is, you know, they always want to release stuff before it's ready, and the bugs in programs, no matter who puts them out, are legion, and they're not as friendly as they're purported to be, the programs, and you know, they make difficulties for people. And the more complex they are, the more difficult they are, and the more buggy.
So, I had a thought there. So you mentioned Nolan. Nolan was the guy who came up with the idea of Photoshop?
He is the guy. Yes, he's still working on it.
He's a big name, some historical name. I mean,
in that industry, yes. He doesn't work for Adobe. He's independent, but Zalman and he work closely together.
And then, what is the final cut? Who did he work with on that?
Well, he was working for Macromedia at the time. It was their product before they were bought by Adobe.
I see.
It's a video editing program. It's the video editing program.
Right. Is he still employed at Adobe?
Yes.
Okay, so looking at my notes, the next point is, we were talking about Rip Torn's place in Mexico. I have a note here. Judy and Zalman, Patty and Ever go to Rip Torn.
Yes, we've probably only got one more subject.
Right. Let's see. Sally edits Huey Newton and Rabbi Zalman tapes. Now, Jonathan Altman, you didn't mention that his father funded the Dead Sea Scrolls, funded the archiving?
His stepfather designed the building.
For the Dead Sea Scrolls in Israel?
Yes. Stepfather, architect.
So looking...
wealthy family.
Right, and why do we bring him? He's the one that... How does that connect to the Lama Foundation? Why?
He funded the buying of the land.
But this other guy, Israel, who was Rael...
He owned the land. We bought it from him.
So what happened to Jonathan Altman? Is he still involved with the...
He lives in Santa Fe now. And I don't know. He's not terribly involved with Lama, but somewhat.
Okay, so what? Here's a concept, a theory. McLuhan talked about the satellite, Sputnik, and then the subsequent satellite environment turned the Global Village into Global Theater, and it meant, at that point in the early 60s, the programming of all the older media environments. So he talked about how it was a programmed happening, the Global Theater, under the effect of satellites. I see that you presented the programming, you mimed the programming of the satellite environment with the 1963 performance happening in San Francisco. Later at Intermedia, other institutions, business, underwater people, they all gradually got used to being massaged by an environment. The transition in the 60s of people programming themselves was drugs, but then mainstream business organizations or corporations started to accept the idea or think that maybe we need a programmer or our customers or program our staff. This programming that McLuhan was talking about in the early 60s now becomes what he would say a cliche, and Intermedia is capitalizing as much as it can and making money on the new trend of people thinking they need to be programmed, like classroom climates. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that the overlap of the...
But it goes further than that. In Venezuela, we do Caracas para Todos. It's basically propaganda. And eventually, the fact that we were propaganda agents, and I don't mean just in Venezuela, but for corporations and for government, got to me, and I didn't want to keep doing it.
Right. So this would be our last topic. Let's talk about how Venezuela happened. which happens in 73, 74. You did do some programming at WGBH, the Boston TV station.
Yes.
You did some work with the video and helped. As a matter of fact, I think at your home years ago, you showed me some of that programming. And I remember it had a Namjoon Paik, I think, performance piece. Remember you were showing me the video?
We used the Paik Abbey. I used the Paik Abbey synthesizer for a piece that I did for GBH, but that was funded by Rockefeller and by the Massachusetts Council.
Right, and that's as Intermedia, and the Venezuela...
No, that's as Gerrit Stern. As Intermedia, we did a big national production in Washington for the National Endowment of the Arts with WGBH. We did actual... We made programs for them about, you know, for showing that Intermedia shot film, audio.
But the WGBH is some of your, the video is your work, more of Gerd Stern.
Yes.
Private.
Yeah.
Okay, so this leads into Venezuela, which... I guess if you finish with them in 76, then they show up in your life in 73, 74, right? You get a call from a guy, and you think it's
yeah.
a friend imitating with a foreign accent, says,
yeah,
Mr.
Right.
Stern, are you Intermedia? I read an article on you. I'm a Venezuelan. So he comes into the office, and you can't believe what he proposes.
Yeah.
But it turns out to be real, and you go to Venezuela. You want to discuss your impressions of that country and culture? You really thought the artist community was great. Once you got
we had a very good scene there for a while, and then there were politics intervened, and the guy who had been our juice was basically exiled, and we didn't get paid, and it was kind of a disaster.
Right, but for a couple of years, you're going down there a lot, working with...
I'm commuting, and we have an apartment that the government pays for, and we have employees, and we do five or six projects. We're also doing a few projects for other companies that aren't the government.
What is it about, is there something special about Caracas or Venezuela's artistic community? You say they have a very good modern art museum there. Is there something that New Yorkers... weren't aware of going on in Venezuela? Is it something you like?
I don't know. It was, you know, it was a very rich country. It was a very creative ferment. And it isn't that way any longer.
No. So the thing is that you're working with this, your main juice guy, who then becomes a politician, and he divorces his wife, he marries a rich lady, I think, oil family, and then they push him to run for politics, and then you found that he would use you, when you go around making documentaries of poorer parts, the burials, or whatever, mm-hmm. he would make himself look good on video, and, well, I don't know, that he got...
Well, we weren't doing video, we were doing mostly multimedia.
So this would be imagery from the burials that you would use.
Well, but we did 360-degree things in a dome, and we did the battlefield of Carabobo Memorial and for Simon Bolivar. We did very large projects.
Yeah,
and film.
Bolivar's career amazed you when you researched him.
Yeah.
How he ended up penniless. A national hero, but penniless. Why was he penniless?
He was abandoned by all of his associates. You know, he had conquered the Spaniards all over South America and liberated the continent and became the president of the republic and the general and politics eventually dismissed him, and he died.
Democracy dismissed him.
Well, it wasn't democracy, it was autocracy.
Hmm. What was his native country?
It purported to be Venezuela.
Oh.
But, I mean, he came from a Spanish family, but he was born in Venezuela.
So the... So then we're talking about the programming. Your intermediate programming environments for corporations, and you decide you don't want to do that anymore. Interesting.
Well, it's a kind of complex situation. You know, the
Chapter 11 bankruptcy didn't help.
No, it didn't. But it needed to be done. But, the projects, had gone further and further away from anything to do with arts and culture, and more and more into commerce and propaganda. I was doing it, but it wasn't really turning me on.
Right. Now, what was art doing in the 70s anyways? What was art? You know, the whole art world had a crisis, I guess.
I don't know. I guess, I was out of it.
Right. You were too successful.
And I've never quite... I'm back in it, but in a very different position.
Well, you're an eminence grease now.
Yeah, really.
You're a footnote in history.
I am my own past. I'd rather be my own present.
Right, but what is the present now? We'll get into that in the next session. But the thing is, I keep thinking of Andy Warhol and how he said, "I am a camera," and they talk about this in this 4-hour American Masters documentary how indifferent he was to the fates of the people that would be the content in his films and theatrical presentations, and it seemed to be callous, but he said he was a camera, so I was thinking that he was miming the satellite programming effect, consciously or unconsciously. Most people, it's divided. Those who think he was mentally ill or a junkie or whatever, that his art is garbage. Those that look at the context of his art, they think he's a genius. But it's interesting that he does parallel what you did in mixed media, does the programming, he becomes the factory, and then with Paul Morrissey, they get into Hollywood and make movies. But he, in the early 70s, he kind of drops that and goes back to painting and just being a conventional artist to make money. That corporatization of the art movements of the 60s is what you went through, too.
In a way.
But the media environments were the new art forms. What you were doing was what the people wanted. They thought that was art. They were corporations, but they wanted them.
But, we felt, in a sense, I'm talking about Michael and I now, that we had been co-opted. Michael feels it even stronger than I do. He feels somewhat, and I agree with him, feel somewhat guilty about some of the techniques we evolved, which are then, used in quick cutting and multiple sounds without necessary synchronization for, ads and promotions. And, we ourselves, in a sense, kind of pioneered that.
Yes, and he does say that. That's obvious in his interview in Art Form in the May issue.
Yeah, and he said it in Liverpool 2 years ago.
He's still saying it, yeah.
Yeah.
So that, we'll end this section on that. That's something I want to talk about. I want to go into thinking about that, plus you go into the cheese business, and then about your return to the art world in a... timely thing because it's the 40 years, well, a couple of years ago it was the 40 years of, 30 year, what, 40 year anniversary of 67 and all that. Some part of the generations are looking back at what happened in the 60s, and these people who are in museums they might be in their 40s now, and they're looking back at what happened, and you've been invited to a lot of places the last 5 years.
That's true.
Right. So let's end this session, and we'll get into the present, or move through a little bit of the cheese world and what you learned from that. And then I'd like to go into the Reality Club. Again, John Brockman shows up in the 80s, and you're part of that. So that'll be the next part, okay?
That started earlier than the 80s.
Okay, we'll correct that.
Well, take a look at it. Okay. All right, thanks a lot. We'll talk then.
Right, thank you, Gerd.
Scott, be well.
I will, thank you.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Bye.